Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, glistening in the Fukushima sun. My very special guest is the Sean David Morton. Welcome, guys.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to see you. I like your new Skype picture, too, Guerrilla Media, although do you have a bug's head? If it's Guerrilla Media, I don't know, shouldn't you be a gorilla? You look like kind of a praying mantis, or is that a gas mask of some kind?
It's actually a V for Vendetta mask.
Is it really?
Yeah. You know, because I'm Vinny, starts with a V. I thought it was fitting.
Yeah, but you can't, no. It's, no, really?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, there's larger versions
of
it.
Oh, I see. So it's, wait, way down in the middle. Okay, so it's like Guy Fawkes, but you're wearing like a weird hat or something. You've got like a... like a helmet on or something. It's that's very strange. Okay.
The whole idea of the concept is like turning media into a military operation. So
right. What
we've got there is we've got, instead of a weapon, instead of a sidearm, for example, being held, you've got a megaphone being held. And instead of a throat mic and a communication devices in order to keep touch with all your soldiers, you actually have a handheld radio and broadcast transmitter that enables you to send and receive signals and monitor enemy communiques instead.
Oh, okay. All right, so now I'm getting it's very small, actually, because it's a little tiny Skype thing. So now I see what you're talking about. Now I see you're holding a megaphone, and you have what looks like a Guy Fawkes mask with a some kind of helmet, it's the helmet that makes you look like a bug, because it looks like it looks like a praying mantis kind of on the top. But that's a great concept. That's very interesting.
Well, naturally, also, media activists like myself get very tired. So in that picture, we're also wearing fatigues.
Ah, there you go, because you're fatigued. That's good.
I do. I kill me. All right.
I'm glad somebody does.
Yeah. You know, this is the way I'm going to go out, son. Speaking of the way we're going out, apparently you've been helping a lot of people with legal cases and things of that nature. But before we go into that, I want you to please promote your show and your time slot on Revolution Radio there.
Okay, Revolution, actually revolution-radio.com, revolutionradio.tv, what else we got? Revolutionradio.tv, and actually we've got our new independent YouTube archive channel, which is also revolutionradio.tv, and freedomslips.com. I don't know where freedomslips came in, but we've got revolution-radio.com, revolutiontalkradio.com, freedomslips, and then the new website for all of our YouTube downloads is revolutionradio.tv. And then, of course, people can come to my website to download the archives of the program, which is strangeuniverseradio.com, because I was one of the creators of the original TV show on the United Paramount Network back in the 90s, which was actually called Strange Universe. And I've always just liked the name because it encompasses sort of everything. So we're on from in California from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m., which translates to, what time is it there?
It translates to about 10 a.m. till midday in New Zealand time.
Oh, there you go. So it's middle of the day. People can listen to the program. You can get it on any of your mobile devices, you know, your iPad, your iPhone, your Galaxy, your Zune, or, you know, whatever it is. So we're truly global now. It's actually fun because the show is, I think out of 10,000 internet radio stations, I think we're 77th in the world. And we always seem to be beaten by like Zumba music. And the number one, it's funny, on the internet, the number one program in the world is like Mariachi Today, which is very strange because I wouldn't think that Mexicans would all be walking around with, you know, internet radios. But number one is Mariachi Today. And actually, Alex Jones gets up in the top six because he works a trick where anybody that tunes in or hits any of his websites out there actually then counts as a listener. So, you know, our numbers are actually very legitimate. So we're 77th out of 10,000 stations. To give you an idea, ABC online is like 1,620. MSNBC is like 4,000. So the mainstream media is getting its ass kicked in so many different ways. And at the same time, I think the reason that Revolution Radio was pulled off of YouTube is because Nighthawk, the guy that runs the station, Mike Ringling, actually was playing live the police dispatches from Ferguson, Missouri, where this big riot is going on there. And for whatever reason, YouTube pulled the channel because he had the live police dispatches going to tell people what was kind of going on in the area. So anyway, StrangeUniverseRadio.com. Please hit the website. You can find out about all my books and And audios and tapes and everything else. So there it is.
And just, you know, personally, Sean's a lot like me, ladies and gentlemen. He's got a really great radio personality, and he does so 5 days a week. You have to have a very strong personality in order to be able to do radio 5 days a week and do it with longevity. Longevity is the key word here.
Thank you. Or be able to read actual stories. I've come up with enough stuff to talk about every day.
I'm talking to gravelly voice.
Yeah. It's like, well, I don't drink enough scotch or smoke enough cigarettes to sound like Art Bell. Although yeah. I could get, it was very funny because Art Bell had a like a bass, he had like a bass modulator so that he had that. This is Art Bell. Welcome to Coast to Coast AM. Now, he called my house once. And my wife answered the phone. She goes, hello. And he goes, hi, is Sean there? She says, who's this? This is Art Bell. She's like, no, it isn't. Yes, it is. It's Art Bell. He goes, no, it's not. This doesn't sound like Art Bell. And he goes, hang on. And he goes, this is Art Bell. And she goes, oh, it's Art Bell. And, I mean, I'm not saying he sounded like Pee Wee Herman or anything, but he kind of did. It's like, so.
Reminds me of my producer, Mitch.
Yeah, great. Exactly. Yeah. So with all the, you know, all the bass and all the tweaking and all this stuff, he's got like a 32 slider soundboard in his house that makes him sound all spooky.
Is Art Bell still around?
Yeah, he was on. Oh man, he came back for a period of time and had a deal. He got seduced by XM Sirius Radio, and he came back with a show called Dark Matters, and then started basically transmitting on his website and all these downloads and all these and basically streaming on the net. And of course, XM Sirius says to Art Bell, you know why we have you on, don't you? You know that we're trying to get people to buy satellite radios. Now, remember, Art Bell from back in the day, you know, when he quit way back in like 98 or, you know, 2000 or whatever it was. You know, a lot of his audience is kind of dead and, you know, might be dead. And the most advanced piece of technology they owned was an AM radio that worked out of their, you know, worked on batteries out of their trailer parks. So, there weren't a lot of people that were very excited about buying satellite radios. So when XM Sirius tried to explain to him that, you know, your job is to help us sell subscriptions of people that come in that will actually pay to hear you. And for whatever reason, that upset Art because he wanted his largesse to be transmitted, I guess, for free on the internet or whatever with advertisers. And so he came back, I think, for a grand total of 3 weeks and then stormed off and quit. And, of course, now he signed a non-compete, so he can't be on the radio anywhere, apparently, for, I guess, 3 years. So now he's got a Dark Matter. He's got some other radio hosts on Dark Matter. The only one that's any good is Solaris Blue Raven. Who's my friend, and I say that because she's my friend and she's a good radio host. But that's about it. So that's what happened to Art Bell. So yes, he came back, he was around, and then he stormed off and quit. So
because I wasn't really familiar with him. In fact, you know, because I'm a New Zealander, I never really heard his show. Because George Norrie took it over before I even became aware that there was even such a thing as scumbaggery. You know,
right?
And
the perfect and, word. Very good.
And, I thought he'd been died of cancer or abducted by aliens or something like that. It's like, George, yes, come and host the show for me, bro. I've got an appointment on Krypton. It's like, no problem.
Well, Norrie was just so lucky because he got the job simply because he used to run a little tiny show in, of all places, St. Louis, Missouri.
Yeah.
And he just happened to work for Clear Channel, and he just happened to be connected into the board. And, you know, Art got in this huge fight with Clear Channel and claimed to have hurt his back. And while the music was running, the reason why they used to run that Midnight Express, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the show, but his opening music was Midnight Express, that dun 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 dun, which I always thought was funny that his opening theme music was about a guy that was getting buggered in a Turkish prison. I always thought that was really funny.
Usually about like bad porno low budget porno music.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he played a lot of ABBA, you know, Dancing Queen and Man After Midnight and all that stuff. You know, all this kind of cheesy Eurotrash disco. So Art would call at 10 o'clock. He'd call his producer and say, my back hurts. I don't feel like going on the air. Just to, I think, mess with Clear Channel. And so they would, in a panic, switch everything out, and they'd call George, who'd be sitting there, you know, reading his newspaper. And they just said, you know, can you go on for art tonight? And George took it over and said, yeah, sure. And you can pay me for the times that I'm on. So he inherited, in fact, the number three biggest show on radio. I mean, he's the world's luckiest man. And he inherited like the number three show on radio after Art quit. And strangely enough, actually, when Art quit the first time in 98, when he just said, this is my last broadcast and I'm quitting and I'm never, ever coming back to radio ever again. 10 o'clock the next morning, I got a call from Clear Channel that said, would you like to host the show? And I was very leery. I was like, well, what happened to Art? Well, Art's quit. And I said, yeah, I heard that last night. And I'm like, well, is he coming back? And they said, well, we don't know. And I said, well, and of course, this was my mistake, being polite, because the guy was my friend. And, you know, I'd been on a show a long time. And I knew also that even if I stepped in, that he was going to come back at some future point. So all I said to them, which probably just wrecked it for me, as I said, well, if it's okay with him, it's okay with me. And they said, well, you know, Art Bell is not an executive on this network. And I said, well, you know, I can't be seen to be stepping over somebody's dead body to get a job. If he wants to pass the torch and really quit, which I doubt, I told him, I said, he's probably just having a tantrum or something. You know, I'll do it. But if not, then, you know, it's kind of weird. And it was kind of strange because then a couple hours later, I got a call from Talk Radio Network. And Talk Radio Network was the network that actually had Art Bell and then sold Art Bell for, I think, $10 million to a company called J-Core. And then J-Core was then bought by Premier, and then Premier was bought by Clear Channel. And for people that don't know about Clear Channel started out as a 5,000-watt radio station in the middle of nowhere, and it was it was Mark and Brian May, the father and son team. And they then teamed up with George Bush and Henry Kissinger. This is about 94, 95 or so, and they were taken to the Cayman Islands, and they tapped into something called the Trilateral Cayman Island Trust. And what this was a multi-billion-dollar fund that, in essence, loaned Clear Channel an unlimited amount of money for them to then buy every radio station on Earth, like everything that they get their hands on. So for a couple, so then they bought Art Bell, Rush Limbaugh, Dr. Laura. They took the top 10 personalities in radio and just bought them for like millions of dollars, and then bought every radio station they could get their hands on.
Could I interject?
Radio stations are worth $400,000 or $500,000. They paid like $2 million worth.
Today, Clear Channel still owns about 30%+ of all the New Zealand radio stations as well.
Right, indeed. And what finally stopped them, they own 49% of the stations actually in the United States. And they were going to buy Arbitron, which was the rating system for radio, which would be literally like, you know, having the wolf run the sheep farm.
And it would be like Goldman Sachs buying the ratings agencies or something like that.
Yes, that was
it. Oh, wait, they already did.
They were finally stopped by the FCC. But what their goal was, basically, was they were given these billions of dollars from, you know, Kissinger and Bush. You know, in essence, really with the mission statement to make, one of the Bushes, either Jeb or GW, president of the United States in 2000. And even then they didn't really succeed because, you know, GW got beat in the popular election. They had to cheat and get Al Gore in. But that was pretty much their agenda. So Bell wasn't down with it very much. They always viewed Coast to Coast as kind of a, the redheaded stepchild, and, you know, they're the executives doing the Beverly Hillbillies, really. It was just like little green men from space. And, they didn't like his content. They didn't like the show, but the show was a big success. So anyway, so that's
it. It was the money and the numbers at the end of the day, isn't it?
Not really. Not actually, in my opinion, it was the propaganda. It was that they were after. They were not concerned about money at all. What they were concerned about was content, and that content shifting people from a Democratic president at the time who, through sheer luck, was ruling over the longest period of peace and prosperity in human history from 91 until 2001, when there was not a single war between two nations. You had two civil wars.
Hold on. Let's call that the in-between Bush years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, Clinton is, you know, all tied up with the Bushes, but after Desert Storm in 91, you had a civil war in Rwanda and Burundi that killed almost 2 million people in a little under 6 weeks. And then you had Bosnia, Serbia, Herzegovina, which is the same civil war that's been going on for 500 years. But outside of that, you did not have a single war between two countries. You had the longest period of peace and prosperity. You had billions of dollars being created in the computer industry in San Francisco. It was amazing. I mean, and Clinton, here's another interesting fact about this. For everything that Clinton did, even though it was primarily the Republican Congress that came in and did it, In February of 1998, Bill Clinton balanced the federal budget. In February of 1974, Richard Nixon balanced the budget, the federal budget. By August, Nixon was resigning, and by August of 98, Bill Clinton was under indictment for impeachment because he balanced the federal budget. And what was the first thing that Bush did when he got in? First thing he did was basically he gave away money. He gave away $300 to basically every man, woman, and child.
It was a $350 billion tax cut, if I remember correctly.
But what he did is he paid cash to people. He said, well, we've got a surplus, and it belongs to the American people. We're going to write you all a check. So he wrote millions of people.
Apparently, Michael Moore got his check in the mail, and he'd never seen a paycheck so freaking huge in his life.
$350 for everything. And that then sent us back in the spiral where he had to borrow again, so the bankers were back in control and drove everything up, which now leads us to the global crisis that, as of March, the first quarter of this year, 40 cents out of every dollar of the gross domestic product of every country on earth now goes to interest, now goes to usury. So something's got to give, because you can't just have, because eventually it's going to be half and it's going to get up. And all these usurers are of the Babylonian banking system are seeing the writing on the wall. They understand what's going on. We just talked about the BIS, which is the Bank of International Settlements, in their quarterly report actually said that we can no longer sprinkle pixie dust on the economy anymore, because all you're doing is having money make money, which makes money. And, you know, the derivatives markets are completely out of control. Derivatives are interesting, because a derivative is you have two Irishmen outside a bar and they're betting on what crow is gonna fly off a fence first. And you have another guy who comes along and says, what are you doing? We're betting on that crow. And he goes, I'll take that action. Just because there's money in play, there's like a mathematical thing, because derivatives are nothing. They're nothing. And we've got a quadrillion dollar derivative system out there that's about ready to collapse. You have the biggest thing, and one of the reasons why you're seeing all of these people dying in the financial industries all around the world, is that they're the pawns. They're the lower echelon players that can finger their big bosses at the top. So they're the ones, and about 40 of them have been killed now. But usually when these people are killed, then you have some police agency actually then swoop in, and it's primarily J.P. Morgan. And the rampant crime in commodities right now is so obvious, because you have all of these firms that are all trading silver, and they're trading ETFs in silver, electronically traded funds in silver. Well, we know for a fact that there's only about $25 billion and change. It could be 30 or so, about $25 billion worth of silver on planet Earth. And Bill Gates and Warren Buffett own 30% of that, okay? So the international silver trade market is $5 trillion. So you see the disconnect? It's $5 trillion when there's only $25 billion of silver on the planet. So somebody's getting reamed. And the true price of, at that rate, the true price of silver should be up to about $60 to $65 or so U.S. Because you can actually trade with the paper. But the minute you actually try to get the actual silver, that's going to take you 6 months, and there's all kinds of fees and all kinds of crazy things going on. So while these financial institutions are being investigated and arrested, and there's a lot of interesting stuff going on with the Vatican too, because here you have Pope Francis last year puts out a papal bull, which basically says, this is July 26th or 27th of last year, and a papal bull in a statement that says that the Holy Roman Catholic Church is now removing the protection of the Roman Curia from all of those that would oppress the children of God. Well, what that means is the Roman Curia is basically Roman civil law, which is what all of us are under now. Basically, New Zealand and UK and the United States and Canada, we're all under Roman civil law. So people also don't understand that probably the most badass intelligence agency on earth are the Jesuits. And you don't go anywhere in the Deuxen Bureau or Interpol or FBI or CIA or MI5 or MI6 or any of these intelligence agencies unless you're a Jesuit, unless you go to a Jesuit school and are approved by Jesuits. People also don't understand, too, that Adam Weishaupt, who was a converted Catholic Jew, was raised by Jesuits, and so he understood conspiracy, and the Jesuits assisted in the forming of the Bavarian Illuminati. But in the course of that, now you have the Jesuits, I think, turning positive, where now you have St. Francis, or I'm sorry, not St. Francis, but Pope Francis, now going after all of these people that are scamming people with money in the banks and, you know, the usurers and the basically the Babylonian banking system. So it's very interesting to see that now suddenly some of the stuff that's going on in the financial world is being cleaned up, and it might be the Jesuits who are doing it. So so it's going to be interesting to see what happens when they have to invest in things that are real, when they have to make movies or build buildings or do products or and this might also be what the jumping to one other level here. Now you have 190 countries that are all aligned against the United States that want to destroy American hegemony off over everything and basically kill the dollar. And now you've got White House people saying that they're going to kill the dollar. And the dollar has become the most toxic monetary instrument on earth. And the biggest war right now is over petrodollars and whether or not and pipelines. It's very interesting because pipelines, the reason we wanted to topple Syria was because the Saudi Arabians wanted to put a pipeline through Syria into France so that their oil could compete with the Russians, relatively cheap oil and natural gas.
Could I put in something here? There was also about a $700 billion deposit of natural gas near Israel or something like that, and they also wanted to put a pipeline through Syria and Ukraine in order to get it into the EU market.
Interesting. I heard about that right offshore of Israel. Because Israel has the big secret is Israel has no resources at all. They have to get all their oil from the Saudi Arabians and the bordering Arabs, which is kind of a state secret. It's very strange, but they have no resources really.
Apart from inexhaustible white phosphorus supplies, supplied by the US, of course.
And apparently a lot of bombs to drop on the people in Gaza. So my whole point being is that the reason there are these big wars over pipelines out of not only Afghanistan, but the Ukraine and all these other places was because it's only in a pipeline that you can actually trade it in something other than dollars. Because, we live in a weird world where for the first time since probably since the Spanish Armada in the 16th century, where you have one navy that has complete dominance over all of the oceans on Earth. So you can't get anything in a boat from point A to point B without the tacit or implicit permission of the U.S. Navy. So, and again, the reason you trade in dollars is because the Navy says, well, if you want your boat to get from point A to point B, you better be trading in dollars if you're going to expect our protection. So this is another reason. And if I was Vladimir Putin right now and I want to take on the United States, I would basically say, he could collapse the entire economy. And we know this. If he just turned around and said, here is the deal I give you. You buy natural gas and oil, I give you 50% off. Cut the rate, but you pay in gold and rubles. And people would do it right away. I mean, he could give 50% off oil, slash the price, say, I'll give you the discounted oil if you buy it in rubles or gold. He's already only accepting gold in certain areas. And the U.S. would be done. The only thing that keeps our, quote, empire alive is the petrodollar and us holding a gun to the head of the entire world, saying that you don't get any oil unless you trade it in dollars. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens when either the dollar collapses or, I'm not so sure we can survive two more years of Barack Obama. But that's that sums up, it's all oil at the bottom. And the same people that are responsible for toppling the constitutional government in the Ukraine and then Poroshenko taking over there are very much the same people that were these supposed rebels that got sarin gassed by mistake in Syria, who are now the same people who are directly being funded that we call ISIS, that are now tearing Iraq apart with this guy who's not even an Arab, who's the head guy, this big bad voodoo Baghdadi, this guy, trying to actually put together. And it is interesting because he's calling himself the emir of the caliphate of Baghdad, which is what Muhammad called himself as well. So he's couching himself in this very interesting Islamic doublespeak of paraphrasing things that Muhammad said. And I wrote a book about all this too. I mean, not only did I write Sands of Time, which is the 40-year history of the shadow government and everything that went on behind the scenes and from the journals of a man who disappeared, but I wrote a book called The Veil of the Antichrist, which is all about this and all about what the Vatican's response would be if a Muslim leader was to appear with something called the Book of Truth, which is another book that Muhammad wrote that disappeared in 1196 AD.
Isn't it interesting how after a religion gets established, a book of truth goes missing? I can't believe it. Anyway, we'll come into break just now. I want you to continue that right after you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, listener-supported radio. Donate or start a regular contribution today at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Also check out our sponsors, Blue Shield, the Gourmet Soap Kitchen, and Wagga Wagga. God, I love saying the word Wagga Wagga. It's, I don't know, it sounds like a horny frog. Wagga Wagga.
Wagga Wagga. Wagga.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or a slightly retarded Muppet. Waka waka waka. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Fozzie.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's an extravaganza. It's a fabulous little festival that we got going on here on a regular basis. Not entirely dissimilar from the pedophile bowling alley in the White House. My very special guest is Sean David Morton. The Sean David Morton.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Sorry, any correction?
Good beer.
All right, you know, like
you're great, man. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
He's almost as recognizable as the picture John McCain took with ISIS rebels. You know, you know.
That's funny.
John McCain thought it was he needed to call off, so he took some picture with ISIS. Anyway. What were you talking about before, about how an Arab leader would come in and there'd be a book of truth or something like that?
Well, okay. When Muhammad put together this weird, you know, and Islam is, you know, look, I've read the Quran and I was like, really? People make sense out of this thing? You know, it's not like there's stories like the Bible. It's just basically, oh, we must kill everyone and the infidels must be cleansed. And it's a really strange book, and they've got some very, very odd laws. Apparently, you can have sex with a 9-year-old child, and you're not supposed to eat a donkey that you've recently sodomized. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy stuff in it.
So, well, I thought that just kind of goes without saying, but
so Muhammad goes off to a cave. He gets beaten up by the Christians because they won't accept him. He gets beaten up by the Jews; they won't accept him either. He then goes off to a cave after being really mad that these people beat him up, and he claims that he sees the Archangel Gabriel. He's taken to paradise. And
let me guess, when he told this to the Christians and the Jews, they thought he'd gone off as Muhammad's.
And they beat him up, yes, and they beat the snot out of him. So he goes away. He comes back mumbling about that he has somehow met Gabriel. He gets four of his buddies together, and he just starts mumbling stuff that they start writing down. He writes a second book, which is called the Book of Truth, also known as The Alienation of the Rose. And what he does is he has the hots for an 8 or 9-year-old girl named Ilea. And while she's playing on her swing set, he says, hey, baby, you know, I've got another book in heaven, and I'll give it to you if you be my fourth wife or something. So he basically marries this 9-year-old girl. You're apparently, able to – you can marry them at one. You can actually betroth them at one or two and then marry them at nine. don't ask. So Ilea and her son – then, and this is a whole other thing, then supposedly come up with the Book of Truth. Now, the Book of Truth was probably pretty good. The Book of Truth talked about how the Christians, Muslims, and Jews were all people of the book. And whatever was going on, they did found a caliphate, which was ruled out of Cordoba, Spain, for a period of time. And actually for 300 years, which was known as the Muslim Golden Age, through the 8th, 9th, and into the 10th century, until about 1196 or so. You have this amazing empire. You have hyper advanced science. You have eye operations, brain operations. You have hot and cold running water. You have gaslit streets. You have indoor plumbing. Cordoba, Spain, was like a city from the future when the French and everybody else in Europe were rolling around in the mud, you know, eating grubs.
They didn't even have toilet paper at that time, but these guys did.
I don't know about that, but it's a. But 1196 AD comes along, and somehow the Book of Truth is lost, and things just start going downhill from there. And that's when we start moving in the Crusades, and when they lose Jerusalem, and all these bad things going to happen to the entire empire.
How did you lose Jerusalem? You know, did you just put it down somewhere and then walk away and get too drunk or something? Oh, my God.
Well, that was Guy de Godfrey, I think it was. It was a Guy de Godfrey, and he believed himself to be. He was a big, tall, redheaded, muscular guy that looked just like Jesus, and he believed himself to be the direct descendant of Jesus Christ, and that for a period of about 60 years, you had a king on the throne of Jerusalem who was of the bloodline of Judah, of the proper bloodline and all that, until they lost it again and it went back to the Muslims and what have you. Now, my book, Veil of the Antichrist, I have a character named Father Dominic Lindquist, who is a he's a Jesuit priest who acts as a spy in the Arab terror networks because he's part Bedouin and part Irish. So my first book was actually called Black Seraph, which was all about him battling these terrorists that were actually dealing with a genetic virus. And this was like 2004 when I was talking about genetic weapons. Where
could you explain to me the word seraph after you've finished with the genetic weapon?
Oh, a seraph is it's an angel. A seraph is a six winged angel. It's the same as a seraphim. In the Bible, there's seraphim and cherubim, and the cherubim are we think of them as being little naked babies, you know, with wings, but actually in the Bible they had faces like calves and hooves and pointed tails. That was the cherubim, and the seraphim were six winged angels that were believed to be angels of communication. So that's a seraph. A seraph is a six-winged angel.
Oh, well, so, kind of like that's probably why they called that character in The Matrix Seraph, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, seraph. It's after an angel. So, yes, that's the he was the Chinese guy who was in the white who was the assistant of the Oracle. That was Seraph, if I remember correctly. Yeah. So the so in Black Seraph, it was all about gene bombs. It was all about genetic weapons, being able to build the ultimate smart bomb that you could theoretically drop on Jerusalem and it would kill everybody with Eastern European Jews, genes. I mean, everybody who was Ashkenazic from Eastern Europe, you could kill and just leave the Arabs or Palestinians or whatever. My second book, Veil of the Antichrist, is all about this character that rises up out of Iran with this book, and he puts on a white veil. And I just took all the prophecies of Islam about what they call the 12th Iman, and they still believe that the 12th Iman will come soon and that he wears a white veil and that he's known as the Mahdi or the Makwana, and that he will then unite Islam together. If there was a single uniting force to Islam now, we would be in so much trouble because the only thing that's keeping them down is the fact that they are argumentative and childish. And
I thought it was the huge quantity of depleted uranium the West dumped into them and makes a quarter of their babies born deformed. But, you know, that's me.
That might be it, too. But it's also the philosophy that the way you keep a crab from crawling out of a bucket is you throw in another crab. So, I guess the same thing works with, these Arabs. If you put one above the other, they'll all fight. So and that's, by the way, the point of what's really going on in Iraq. But I'll get that in a second. So this prophet rises up out of the Middle East, and the creepy thing about it is I wrote the book in 2009, and the book predicted the complete collapse of all of these governments across North Africa, beginning with a guy who runs a fruit cart in Tanzania who lights himself on fire because he's being beaten up by the police and has a big sign above his head that says, "May the prophet save us," and everybody puts this on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and all that, and it collapses Tunisia, then it collapses Libya, then it collapses Egypt. And then this whole wave of people who are followers of the prophet collapse all these governments. And then the prophet goes across and he goes to Egypt and he gets some help. And his whole point is to go to and this is the real threat. His whole point is to go to Cordoba, Spain, and pray at the former mosque in Cordoba. If he was to do that, then you're talking about a massive Muslim invasion, the same that's happening here in the U.S. where we're just letting all these – where Obama's opening up the gates to hell to the southern border, just letting everybody in.
Might I interject? Because as far as I know from a lot of my European counterparts, there's already a massive Muslim invasion in the entire EU.
Yeah, and well, because the French let the Algerians in. You can't walk the streets of Marseille anymore because it's all black Algerians. England, which was 97% Anglo-Saxon, in 1945, is now they're now a minority in their own country at 48%. Again, the Native Americans, the American Indians, had bad immigration laws. Now you can't even find two Indians to stand next to each other on a float in a parade. So so my whole book is about what the Vatican would do, and how my character, Dominic Lindquist, who then goes undercover in the Arab terror networks, how he has to now find a way to not only discredit the book but also discredit the man and not have him seen as a martyr. So it goes back into all the history of the Arabs and, how this all works and how it's all repeating itself. I mean, people understand that in order to get the Muslims out of Europe, it took Charles the Hammer Martel, who finally came in and finally drove them out of Spain, what they called the Moors out of Spain. So, and now they're just letting them all back in. Why? France this is the whole revolution in France because their immigration policies are terrible, and people are basically being bred out of their own countries. And, you know, unfortunately, these Muslims get in, and they're lazy as hell, and, you know, they basically live off welfare, and they have tons of kids. That's the other thing that the Israelis are facing as well, is they realize that there's, in a country of 6.3 million people, within 20 years, they're going to be basically bred out of their own country unless they, you know, do something about it. But
oh, don't worry, they're working on it again.
Yeah, they're working on it. And anybody
it's the miracle cure.
Anybody who thinks that they're not going after women and children has never read the Bible, because the Bible does say you're just supposed to wipe everybody out. So, you know, so there it is. Anyway, so, and how does this relate to ISIS? Because it relates to ISIS, where the goal of the U.S. has always been to balkanize Iraq and that whole area and split it up into smaller sections so that it can be more easily controlled. And that's in essence what they're doing now, that you're going to have the Kurds in the north, you'll have the Sunni in one area, the Shiites in another area, you know, other in someplace else, and, you know, basically just split Iraq up into pieces. And the U.S. is backing all of it. I mean, even the guy that's the head of it, Baghdadi, he's an actor. He's not even an Arab. He's actually funny because when he talks, he's got this veil on, but he's wearing the $60,000 Rolex Submariner.
Have you ever seen the superhero movie Kick-Ass?
Yes, of course.
You know, so I was just thinking about this. We'll do a Photoshop thing. We'll put Hit Girl next to Baghdadi.
Oh, that'd be funny. That'd be good. I like that. I also think that, you know, there's these videos that people are sending me about, oh, here's the savagery of ISIS. And from a production standpoint, these videos are just outrageously fake. The one where they're executing people in the dirt, there's no blood, there's no brains, they've got one where they're throwing people at this one guy who's supposedly slitting their throats and throwing them off a pier. And it's so obvious that these guys are just swimming under the pier because there's no bodies, there's no other blood. So these propaganda videos of how savage they are, I'm not sure, again, are not just videos too. Once again, why do we fund these guys? Because now the United States is talking about getting back into the war, and, you know, airstrikes and saving dams and doing whatever. And, you know,
Sean, in your experience, when was the last time a terrorist group that the United States either did like or didn't like was one that they didn't fund and create themselves?
Never. Well, there is no terrorist threat in the world. It's all being funded by the West.
Well, I disagree. Because by the very, very definition of terrorism, it's a system of government whereby the government terrorizes its own people into doing what it wants.
Yeah, that's 1984. That's Emmanuel Goldstein. Again, you have to have the external threat of war with the big countries. You know, Eurasia is at war with East Asia, and it has always been at war with East Asia. And then you have Emmanuel Goldstein on the inside, who's the terrorist with his manifesto. Which then gives them the excuse for security and, you know, what have you, on a global level. I'm hoping that, I mean, places like New Zealand that are so relatively peaceful, and you've got, what, 4 million people there. You've actually got more sheep than you have people in New Zealand.
There's no people. There's just sheep.
That's funny.
But get this. I'll give you a bit of a background about how safe New Zealand is. Okay, so we did a bit of analysis of some of the changes in our defense budgets, legislation, things like that. Dig this. We had an operation here. It was called Operation Catapo. Catapo is the most poisonous spider in New Zealand, right? Uh-huh. It was a training exercise to depose a freely elected anti-US leader who became the Prime Minister of New Zealand. This was the exercise. And it was the largest amount of foreign troops in New Zealand since World War II. And the terrorists that they had to take out on the beach landings and things like that were protesters holding placards with anti-American slogans. Huh. Now, my question is, will the US protect its financial interests in New Zealand by force, if necessary, right? And secondly, NATO, our Federal Reserve, former Federal Reserve employed banker, Prime Minister John Key, signed us up to a partnership agreement with NATO, which is the world's pseudo-private army of the banking cartel, right?
Yeah. Right, yeah.
And then he says, you know what we want to have in US in the New Zealand waters again? The US Coast Guard. And he actually has stated publicly that he wants to give the US Coast Guard jurisdiction over New Zealand waters. Some harbours in New Zealand are being dredged to make them deeper, okay, and we've already capable of carrying the world's largest cruise liners. So, what ship is bigger than a cruise liner? Only one.
Battleships, aircraft carriers,
right? Aircraft carriers. Now, it's now illegal for New Zealand police to pull over foreign military vehicles on our road. It didn't used to be illegal, but they changed the legislation around that. We're a strategic nuclear sub-outlet. Subs, generally, the idea is to fire missiles in the northern Pacific into bigger targets and then escape into the underwater trenches and travel undetected all the way to New Zealand. We just have a massive remodel of what's called the Ohakia Air Base with new fences, other high-tech upgrades costing millions, and they say to the public that this is because we're getting up to 10 new helicopters. All right? And that's basically all the changes that I've come across so far in terms of just military standing. And just those few little bullet points is like, whoa, New Zealand's going to be taken the frack over by the elite, isn't it? That's what it says to me. That's what it screams at me.
Huh. Well, the hilarious part about it is, or the sad part is that the Coast Guard, there were people during the Vietnam era that signed up for the Coast Guard thinking that they would not have to go to Vietnam, when they then began to realize that they didn't tell you which coast the Coast Guard was supposed to guard. So they sent them to Vietnam because they said, well, it never says in the charter, theoretically, it's any coast anywhere. It's just a Coast Guard, not a U.S. Coast Guard. So they sent the Coast Guard guys to Vietnam, and that's exactly what they're doing to you. They somehow have the jurisdiction to guard the coast there. Do you think, Vinny, that what they're doing in New Zealand might have to do with these massive underground cities in Australia near Pine Gap and Pine Gap and Alice Springs? Is that it? And I talked to a guy.
Pine Gap's a couple of hundred k's from Alice Springs.
Because I know that Alice Springs and Pine Gap were like the area. They're supposedly like the Area 51 of Australia. Yeah. And the I talked to a guy in Kellogg, Idaho, who worked for a mining company. And he made giant gears. He made these huge wheels that were like 100 meters across that were used for massive underground digging. And this was 15 years ago. And this guy said, look, we work, 6 days a week. We don't have to advertise. We can't keep up with the orders. And I said, where's all this underground equipment going? And he said, it's all going to Australia. I said, Australia? And he goes, they're building some kind of gigantic underground city there, like a whole area. I'm like, why? And he goes, well, they say because they think the planet might flip over.
Have you interviewed Leonce Keeley before from Pine Gap?
No, I haven't. I'm sure I would love to talk to him.
I have, and he said that there's already a giant underground facility there. He said you have to have you actually had to have vehicles underground in order to get from one end of one room to the other.
Right.
Like giant, huge, and almost like 20 miles in every direction around the facility is off limits to human activity, like deadly force authorized kind of thing. Right. And it's just, when it comes down to it, everything ties into the one overall agenda, which is the one world government. Now, New Zealand's strategically quite a great asset in terms of a holiday destination. This is basically what I think is going on here. We're a strategic asset in terms of Navy, which has really pissed the U.S. off because of their don't ask, don't tell nuclear ship proviso program. We won't tell you whether or not our ships are nuclear power. So New Zealand goes, well, we won't want to have any of your ships here anymore. And so naturally, once we elect a Federal Reserve banker as the Prime Minister, he wants to allow all those ships back in. So strategic South Pacific regional command with aircraft carrier facilities, large amounts of land capable of growing arable farming, things of that nature. Also quite lovely and picturesque, and we have an awful lot amount of incredibly wealthy individuals now moving to New Zealand, including James Cameron, who bought a huge tract of farmland. One of my listeners once asked me, Vinny, how expensive is farmland down there in New Zealand? And I say, well, let me put it like this. The only two farmland purchases that I've heard of recently have been sold to giant Chinese conglomerates and James Cameron. It's not that cheap, bro.
Interesting. So what it all points to is that it's, on the one hand, they seem to be preparing for the worst. But I also think that, and this is what I try to point out in my book, Sands of Time, is that in Sands of Time, it's the development of time travel. It's behind the scenes at the Montauk Project, Area 51, the Dulce Mesa War, You know, our cooperation with certain extraterrestrial species, some good, some not so good. And the biggest thing to me is it seems as though there's a group of what I call autocrats and technocrats. The autocrats are in the process of basically setting up the whole new world order, you know, putting the cages together and building the prison and the jail to, you know, make it so. And this goes all the way back to the U.S. bankruptcy of 1933, is that, you know, the real tyranny that's involved here is that you have all these corporations that are disguised as governments. And anybody that doesn't believe me, you know, just look up a local court and you'll find there's a Dun & Bradstreet number, there's a Doing Business As, there's a DBA. So they're not really the government. They're not really the judicial branch. They're a private company, you know, that's there to basically interact with you as the corporation, as the straw man, as the hologram in the matrix, so to speak. You know, so they can just fleece you of more money. And in essence, they want to get rid of various anything where the people would have a say in their exploiting them, basically. You know, anything that says we can't exploit you, they trample and they get rid of.
Mm.
So on the one hand, you have the autocrats that are setting up this totalitarian kind of jail. However, on the other hand, you have these very, very powerful, I guess you could call them technocrats, that have access to a level of technology that is above anything that we know of. But there's a huge divide between these two. So you've got tech that commercial R&D tech is about 3 to 5 years ahead of what's introduced to the public. And of course, you know, they have to figure out how to make it break as soon as the warranty gives out. Then you've got military technology, which is maybe 10 or 15 years ahead of anything we know. And then you've got a level of technology beyond that that maybe is 20, 25, maybe even 50 years older or, you know, better. And I've seen some of this stuff with my own eyes. I mean, I saw outside of the UFOs or the smaller scout ships that we used to see at Area 51 when we go out there like every Wednesday night back in 91, 92, 93. I mean, they had one thing that flew over our heads that was 1,600 feet from tip to tail that looked kind of like a Darth Vader's ship in Star Wars, except not pointed. It had a blunt shovel nose on it, and it was white on the. It was black on the bottom and white on the top, with three big retro rockets on the back. And this thing was coming in from space, and it was somehow not calibrated correctly, and it was creating these massive shock waves, these sonic booms that were creating what they called skyquakes. And this thing flew right over our heads. And this was the only time that the camo dudes or the whacking at security guys actually chased us, because they thought that we had video of this thing. And so we, you know, jumped in the truck, and my buddy John Hadley had a pair of night vision goggles on, and he disconnected his brake lights. And so we're, you know, screaming through the Nevada desert doing 120 miles an hour in his truck, listening to, with all the lights out, with him blasting Highway Star on his cassette deck by Deep Purple. And we got to the town of Rachel about 18 miles away, and we hid, and these guys didn't catch us. So, but if you take that and then years later, that, you know, that's the tip of the iceberg, because you think, how many people have to work on that? What's the support staff like? How much money does it take to do? And then you have a guy named Gary McKinnon who comes out in, once again, 97, 98. And McKinnon uses some Ukrainian software to hack some U.S. Military databases. And, you know, which only cost us, according to the people in the know, it cost us about $700,000 or so in damages. But what he found, what he stumbled across, was basically an extraterrestrial navy that they call the Nebraska Navy, because a lot of it's run out of Strategic Air Command out of Omaha, Nebraska. And he found officers, ship manifests, classes of craft that were all off-world, that was an entire basically Star Trek fleet with, like, you know, the USS Enterprise and the Constellation and the Farragut and whatever else that was then servicing bases on the moon and Mars and all the way around. So these autocrats, I think, are, number one, they're trying to build a solar system-wide defense grid to protect us from something very big and very bad and very nasty that they believe is on its way here, that will end in some kind of end of days judgment type war sometime in the 2020s. And the more they would describe it, the more I would continue to think of this scene where they talk about the Nordics taking on these reptilians from after Conus, and that they were fighting over Earth, that Earth was in kind of a contested area of space. And the more I began to think about the book of Revelation, where it talks about a battle in the heavens with the archangel Michael, and that Michael tries to bind the red dragon with the chains of forever, but Michael is wounded, and he's wounded and retreats, but then he casts the dragon onto the earth. Well, that's exactly what these people are saying, that their goal is to have them engage these Nordic types that are supposedly on our side, that they're going to then get through, and then they're going to be basically cast down to the earth where we then trap them here, but then we've got to deal with them once they get here. And all this stuff, and I've heard this from four or five different really, really major sources on the inside. Heard it first from Al Bielek back in the late 1980s, who claimed to be one of the survivors from the Philadelphia experiment. But then I also heard it from, you know, other top-level guys. With my response being, this just sounds like another, you know, USSR Russian boogaboo that you guys are just creating us to spend more money and have another reason for the military-industrial complex to exist. Mm. But also what they're doing as well is they're fixing the planet. So their three concerns are, one, extraterrestrial invasion. That's number one. Number two, the sun, that the sun is out of flux or out of kilter, and that they were very afraid that cycle 24, which is what we're going through now, was going to create massive CMEs and X-class flares and fry everything on the planet.
Basically, and it'll have everybody with their heads in their hands going off for flux sake.
But if you look at what the sun's doing now, the sun is completely quiet. I mean, utterly quiet. There's no sunspots. It just had a very small kind of burp where it just kind of went up and went back in again. But there's no sunspots. There's no CMEs. There's no nothing. The sun just went completely quiescent some time ago. And I'm pretty sure I know what they're doing.
Well, Sean, I'm sorry. So we're coming to the end of the show now. If you know what they're doing, please wrap it up, and then we've got to go.
They're creating zero-point energy black holes near the sun. The Norway spiral was actually one of these in order to suck energy off the sun. And the other thing they're doing also is they're realigning the nodal axis of the Earth, and they're using earthquakes to stop Earth changes from happening and realign the nodal axis. And these earthquakes are happening in 188-day cycles, which is actually pi r squared times 60, which is what we actually view time in. It comes out to 1.88888. And the Fiji earthquake, 188 days later, was the Bio-Bio earthquake in Chile, which also altered the nodal axis by about 5 inches or so. 188 days later was the earthquake in New Zealand, which, of course, you all felt there. It was like a 7.2 or something. 188 days later was then Fukushima. And 188 days later, you can then go across the ocean, and there were earthquakes on the San Andreas Fault. Not only were they on the San Andreas Fault in Mexico, but the Mexicans, 3 months in advance on those days, held an earthquake preparedness drill. When these quakes hit, it was a 7.4 and a 7.6, they had everybody outside wearing hard hats. All the schools were cleared. All the factories were cleared. So somebody somewhere is helping us and making sure that the planet is still here on that level. But that doesn't stop the political guys from, once again, building this cage. So, anyway, that's what my book Stands the Time is about. Thank you for your time, Vinny.
Thank you for yours. And also, just to remind everybody, in New Zealand, our earthquake here happened on the exact same day as a massive disaster drill, and they had 1,000 troops in town for this operation. They also had 9 U.S. Congress people here, and they also had the U.S. head of FEMA. The 9 U.S. Congress people jumped on a plane and got out. But the guy from FEMA stayed, and 2 hours later, the earthquake hit.
Isn't that interesting? Well, they're in this. They're in a pattern. They're in a cycle. Actually, they figured this out at Cornell University, actually, in 2011, where they actually noticed this 188-day cycle that seems to actually then correlate with pi r squared times 60, which is 1.888. And Greenwich Mean Time was established in 1888.
And guess what? We have a HAARP facility, not 15 minutes drive from Christchurch, called Birdlings Flat. You can't make this stuff up, folks. No. Thank you very much, Sean David Morton, ladies and gentlemen. We will see you again sometime, and also you can listen to his show from 3 till 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on freedomslips.com, or just Google Revolution Radio. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
See you tomorrow on my show, Vinny.
We will see you again sometime.